Hi, and this is the Physics High Podcast. A quick quiz. Do you A, want to be inspired by science communicators? B, want to learn all about science education? C, want guidance on your scientific journey? Well, how about D, all of the above? Today, my guest is Jeff Wiener. Now, Jeff Wiener is the Teacher Programs Manager at CERN based at Geneva in Switzerland. Now, I had the pleasure of getting to know him when I attended the International Teachers Program in 2019. And what you'll find is Jeff is a passionate communicator of science, got an infectious personality, and really keen to share not only what he does at CERN, but also other areas as well, particularly in particle physics. But it's not up to me to tell you his story. Let's welcome Jeff. Welcome, Jeff.
Hello. Thank you so much for the very nice introduction and for inviting me. I'm very excited.
Now, I know you are with our times at CERN, but I'm expecting there are obviously not many people in the wider community may know who you are and what you do, and heck, may not actually know a lot about CERN, about what CERN does. What do you do?
Yeah, what do I do? That's a good question. Well, let me first start by at CERN, actually, because it's true. Some people might know what CERN is, but maybe to clarify. So CERN is, we like to call it now the European Laboratory of Particle Physics, or initially it was called the Conseil Européen pour la Recherche Nucléaire. I will not continue speaking in French, of course. So it's the largest research laboratory in the world. It's located in Switzerland, in Geneva. And I have the pleasure, I'm a very fortunate person. This you will, you know that already, and I will come back to that every time. I'm very fortunate because I'm at the moment serving the organization as the so-called Teacher Programs Manager, which means we run an extensive professional development program for in-service high school teachers from all around the world. Admittedly, if there's no pandemic, it's a little bit more fun. At the moment, we do most of our programs online, if at all. But usually, in normal days, we have about 1,000 high school teachers, such as yourself, travel to Geneva and take part in our programs. So we have one program every week, where we either have one group of teachers from the same country or the same language area. So, for example, we have a Spanish language teacher program where we have teachers from Spain, but also from other Spanish speaking countries come together. Or we have the international teacher programs where we bring together a group of teachers from all around the world, and they then stay at CERN. And our job is, on the one hand, to, of course, update them what's going on. What is it that we are doing in research at the moment? Because we all know that once you start teaching, you have to keep up to date yourself. And this might include, you know, reading articles, reading books. But our approach is to have the real experts who work at CERN, who, you know, work on their Nobel Prize winning experiments, drop the tools, come to our classroom, talk for 2 hours, and then continue working on a Nobel Prize. That's what we want to do. And so they talk to the teachers, but then we also discuss or include discussions on how to get this kind of special knowledge into the classroom. So CERN's approach to that is we want to have all science teachers to be as up-to-date as possible to showcase that to their students, what's going on and how to make it more accessible to the students and the wider general audience. Yeah, so that's in very short.
Very well done. So you are obviously been involved with science education for quite some time. What got you into science education? Can you just give us a little bit of a history? Don't go into the deepest details of your personal experience, but I guess, was it a sort of key moment that got you into science that like sparked your interest, or was it something that's always there? What drove you to explore science as a career?
I have the simplest answer. It was a teacher. It's and I think that's the case in almost all the cases. Whenever you ask a scientist, how did you get there? They always say, I had a very good teacher. And that's also one of the reasons why I enjoy my job so much, because we have the most amazing teachers coming to CERN, and we know that they will multiply and inspire more students, because it's always down to the teachers. We know the teacher is the most important aspect in the educational process. And the same was true for me. So I enjoyed my high school education a lot. I had really good teachers throughout. But then when I was 17, We got a new physics teacher. He was, fresh from university. We were his first teaching experience. And within a couple of weeks, I already knew, okay, that is clear. Science, physics is fascinating. And the way he presented it was just, lively, entertaining, and also with, crazy new ideas, as young teachers always bring them into the classroom. So that was the moment where I knew, okay, physics is the love. That was clear. In addition, I also had a very, very good mathematics teacher. So I always knew I knew that physics was the love in terms of the content, but I also saw how those two teachers, my math and my physics teacher, how they addressed students, how they tried to help them on their learning journey. It was never about you have to learn it. It was always about how can I help you understand that. And I enjoyed that a lot. So for me, the two passions that I saw from those two teachers and others, of course, but I chose those two as my example, is science in general. So math, physics is fascinating because you see the world with completely different eyes once you start jumping or diving deeper into the content, and also how to educate people, how the educational process should look like. That was the impulse that I needed. So when I finished, when I graduated from high school, I knew that I want to become a teacher myself. And I started I signed up to study physics and math, but then after half a year, I noticed that math was not the, it was not the big love, so to speak. Physics was the big love. And then I changed to study, in addition, psychology and philosophy, because I always wanted to combine physics and philosophy, especially. And in Austria, you have a university degree of psychology and philosophy. So I did that, and I, as I said, I'm a very fortunate person. So already before finishing my university degree, there was a big shortage on physics teachers in Vienna, where I was doing my studies. So I got the offer to already start teaching before getting my master's degree. So I went into the classroom when I was, I think, 23, and some of my students were a couple of years younger than me. So that was a very nice experience. I learned a lot. I made a lot of mistakes because, I mean, how else am I going to learn? So that was a fantastic experience. I had awesome students who really, really helped me. They showed me that this is a fantastic job, but also it is a very, very difficult job. Being up to date, being in the moment every day, every hour, every time you have a new classroom in front of you, I enjoyed it a lot, but it was also a lot of learning involved. And then to keep the story short, I quit teaching after 3 years, where I enjoyed it a lot. But after 3 years, I noticed that I don't want to, end up in a classroom. So in very big quotation marks, because in the end, I think teaching is my ultimate fallback. But I wanted to see more. And so then, via some detours, I was super fortunate that I got the offer to go to CERN, initially for a 9-month contract for the Technical University of Dresden in Germany. They sent me there for 9 months, and that was 9 years ago, because I'm a very fortunate person. So they wouldn't let me leave, and I got to do my PhD, a postdoc, and now I'm a staff scientist. So I'm a very happy and lucky person.
Your story reminds me a bit of, I did an interview with Grant Lewis. I'm not sure if you know him, but he's a cosmologist based here in Sydney, and he had a similar concept to what you said, in that really something switched him in when he was in high school, that physics and maths became not about rules and things to learn, but about understanding the universe. And that aligns very much with what you say, really. It's really important that we as educators instill a desire not for learning facts and rules and regulations, but that we instill a passion for science that asks questions that beg to be answered, and it sounds like you had that very similar experience. I look at your title, which is Teacher Programs Manager, and it almost sort of undersells it, because you yourself do some research as well. In fact, I read your article recently on about teacher conceptions of particularly the atomic model, but you've written a number of papers, haven't you, in terms of particularly in particle physics. What, obviously education is a driver for you, but you have a deep passion for particle physics in particular. What drives you there?
Absolutely, that's correct. I think, well, I could phrase it that I'm lazy, but let's rephrase it and say I'm pragmatic. I like pragmatism. So I like to, yeah, to have the best option or the best solution to problems. And particle physics, when I was a university student, I was fascinated by the fact that every single interaction, everything we observe in the universe can be traced back to four fundamental interactions. I mean, that's the basis of particle physics. We have gravity, which we cannot explain within the standard model of particle physics. And then we have the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic interaction. So just by understanding that we can trace back everything on those basic principles, that already was a big selling point for me to get more into particle physics. And then it is true, when I was a PhD student at CERN, I did my PhD in physics, but focusing on how to explain the standard model of particle physics to young students. And as you mentioned, it's never about the facts. I mean, facts are relevant and important, obviously. You cannot discuss deeper meaning without knowing what the aspects are. But there is no need for students of any age to memorize names of particles, for example, which is usually how particle physics is presented. Like you have to be you have to know everything by heart. That's not what it's about. But of course, you need to know the underlying principles and how to explain it to students. That was a big question of my PhD. And I did a lot of research with 12-year-olds actually, because I wanted to see what is possible at this level, and the level means that's before they had any formal science education, to showcase whatever they find interesting and find understandable. Well, then we can use those chunks and introduce it to older students where it's in the curriculum to introduce them to particle physics. So, and by now it is true, I'm not only a teacher programs manager, we are also within our group conducting physics education research. And I have the pleasure of supervising awesome PhD students who do amazing work. I mean, it's really, you know, I was happy when I was a PhD student, but to see what happens in the next generation and how much more advanced they are than me, that's fantastic. So now I'm enjoying being a supervisor where I take all the credit and never the blame. So that's good. And so we are really looking at what are the concepts teachers should know or need to know in order to explain particle physics at certain levels. So what is the scaffolding that we want to have? How can you explain the principles of particle physics to young students? How deep can you go when it goes to older students? That's what we're currently researching.
Now, what you say actually is a nice segue and a bit of a plug opportunity for you. You set up School Lab, which I think a lot of people don't know about, but is so actually instrumental about getting the information out about what CERN does. Do you want to tell us a little bit about School Lab?
Absolutely. Let me rephrase, I'm a very lucky person. So I was very fortunate when I came to CERN, when I started my PhD, in one of my first meetings with my supervisor, he told me, blah, 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 blah. And by the way, I'm looking for a volunteer. And I was like, that's me. And he was like, yeah, that's you. Because CERN had received a donation from the lottery, the local lottery. They gave us 1 million Swiss francs. And CERN said, and it was earmarked for education purposes. So CERN said, okay, now we are going to construct a hands-on laboratory for high school students, because we have really thousands of students who come to CERN every year to visit CERN, and we wanted to offer them something more in addition, so hands-on workshops. So I was the volunteer. Initially, my supervisor said, yeah, you just have to send a couple of emails. That's how it always starts. And then I ended up being the project manager for 1 year. So I was in charge of designing and constructing this huge laboratory, more than 200 square meters of space, lab space. And it was another fantastic learning experience for me, especially discussing, construction things in French with French technicians. That was a very interesting experience for everyone involved. But it worked. It's still standing. It's good. And then, of course, I was in charge of having it constructed, but then I immediately handed it over to the School Lab team. And that is the best case scenario, because the job that they have done, I could have never done. I was super, super happy of designing everything and thinking it through in a pragmatic way of how can it work for so many students on a daily basis, but then they filled it with all the love and the knowledge that is required. And it is true, by now this project, it started a couple of years ago, and it now grew really in a really, really big project. We have a lot of PhD students working on different aspects, and in this case, it's really about hands-on experiments. So our goal is to make education cheaper. That's the first important thing, because we have to make it cheaper and more accessible. So do it yourself experimental setups. And so our team produced a do-it-yourself particle trap, for example, which there is a commercial version. You can buy it for, I don't know, 5,000 euros or francs or whatever. And our version you can 3D print for 30 francs. So it's really, it's a significant reduction in cost. And it's a fun thing to do. And of course, I mean, I have to point out in the background of your image, we see, I mean, it is so beautiful. We see the 3D printed Atlas model. So the magnetic model and magnetic system of the Atlas model of the largest particle detector at CERN, which is also beautiful because, I mean, it looks amazing as we can see from your video, but it also works. So you can really apply voltage to it and you can measure the magnetic field. So long story short, School Lab is our hands-on laboratory where we have workshops on site, but we also know we get a huge number of students. We have about 8,000 people take part in workshops every year, but we know that there are a lot of more students who will unfortunately never be able to take part in those workshops. So for those people, for everyone in, around the world, we have everything online on our website, completely open access, free to download, in different versions, from games to experiments to really advanced stuff. Like we now recently have one of our PhD students designed a beautiful model of a linear accelerator that works. You can control it with Arduinos, and it's a mechanical model. So a ball is being accelerated, but it looks and works brilliantly. So yeah, and there is still more to come. So more and more PhD students are working on it. But I also have to point out that School Lab at some point will come to an end, unfortunately, or unfortunately, gladly. So because CERN at the moment is constructing an even larger education and outreach center called Science Gateway. It's our biggest project at the moment when it comes to education. It will be a huge building at CERN, and it will replace School Lab, which sounds sad at the beginning, but I'm very happy in that sense because we will get two hands-on laboratories in this new Science Gateway. So we will even be able to double our offers to students once they come on site.
No one's going to complain when they knock down the shack to build a mansion. So that's totally fine. Well, you got me excited because I've already printed off a few things from School Lab and I haven't heard about the linear accelerator. I mean, I've got the Rutherford model behind me. I've got the quark models and so forth. So you got me excited. And I'll put the link in the video so people can actually look at it. Slight change of tack now, and I guess a little bit more serious note. There's a lot of misinformation about CERN. There's a lot of conspiracy theories out there. And that's not just CERN, of course. We see it in lots of areas, you know, whether it's about vaccination, about COVID, about climate change and so forth. I'm curious to know your thoughts about the state of affairs and in particular, your thoughts at what might be necessary, which is a big question, to raise the scientific literacy so that science is actually put on a better pedestal for, you know, for betterment of society.
Wow. Okay, yeah, that is not an easy question, but yeah, but it's absolutely relevant. You're absolutely correct. We have a lot of new mechanisms in our world and new technology that is complicating things. I mean, of course, we can talk about social media. We can talk about the internet in itself, which is a blessing in one way. And of course, it's a big problem where I think humankind has not found the best way of how we deal with the fact that information is available at our doorstep instantly. But that also means it's all kind of information. And I think one part of scientific literacy, which is, of course, you know, knowing facts, knowing how to relate them, understanding the scientific process that you have, you know, you have to have evidence. It's always the question, where is the evidence? Where is the proof? But then now it's also how to discern all of that, because we get a huge amount. And I think that is something that that makes it overwhelming to all of us, I believe. I think even the most scientific literate people nowadays find it difficult to see, okay, what kind of sources can I trust? I mean, of course, there are certain sources that are completely stable and we can always rely on them. But in the variety of all different information, when it's new, it gets challenging. So I think what is required in especially the educational process and especially when it comes to our students is to put emphasis on the scientific method at first. So understanding what models mean in science, in all aspects of science, and also the aspect of modeling, that we always have an uncertainty attached to a modeling process, but also that sometimes we have to rely on evidence I mean, no, we always have to rely on evidence, but sometimes there is no evidence, or it's difficult to gather evidence, so that we have to make assumptions about things, and then we have to assign a certain probability. All those aspects, which come completely natural to scientists, are really, really difficult. It's a difficult understanding to and also a difficult thing to convey to students. And I think the at the moment, especially in terms of, you know, both with Corona, but also climate change, which of course is the biggest threat at the moment, not just at the moment, it's the biggest threat, full stop. I think the ability to discern data, to understand and interpret data is an ability that we really need to put emphasis on in the future. And for example, there's one of the best projects that I love at the moment is called Our World in Data. It's a project from University of Oxford. It's Max Rosa and his team who do amazing work. I mean, they have been slowly building up, and I was fortunate. I found them via Twitter a couple of years ago, and I've been following them. And of course, now during Corona, they are now really famous because they are essentially the authority when it comes to comparing different efforts in different countries when it comes to vaccinations. And they are preparing the data in a way that is accessible, which is really helpful for students and for anyone who is not deep in the field. But I think we also need to teach how to look at data and how to analyze it.
Is there enough being done at the governmental level? What's it? I mean, I guess that's maybe something particularly for people at CERN, because ultimately governments are paying basically for everything there. And yeah, so what do you think of the state of affairs there? Do you think there needs to be more money put into science and science advisory in terms of governments? Because clearly there's some lack of science understanding in governmental levels.
Another very simple question, thank you. I mean, the easy answer is there can always be more money put into science, into education, obviously. I think at CERN, as you rightly point out, we are funded by our member states and associate member states, who all give the money according to their gross domestic product, so it's percentage-wise. At CERN, we are very happy to get this budget. But of course, if we were to get more money, well, we would not complain. We could do more things, obviously. So there can always be more money put in there. I think listening to scientists and really appreciating scientific consensus, because there are some areas where it's really, really clear what the science says, but it is just, I mean, it is against our lifestyle. I mean, if you talk about climate change, for example, it's quite straightforward. We are over-consuming, and when I say we, it's a couple of countries or even a couple of continents who are over-consuming our resources, and this leads to problems. So the science is clear. The question is just, how do we want to change that? I mean, do we want to change that? And in if so, in which way? So there, it's not just about the funding. Of course, funding is always an issue, but it's also about the willingness to listen to scientists and being able to implement it, for example. So especially when we talk about governments, yes, I mean, sometimes it is shocking to see how much governments are focused to look more on when is the date of the next election rather than what is good for society. And if it's not popular within the public opinion, well, then unfortunately it's not going to happen. Of course, this is frustrating, but this is how democracy works. And it's something that it just takes time. Unfortunately, especially when it comes to climate change, we don't have time. We just don't. It's sometimes it feels really frustrating that you have scientists and again and again stating that it is 12:05. It's already too late to go back to normal, whatever normal is. But we really have to take action now. And I mean, let's rephrase it positively. If there is one silver lining or one learning opportunity from this pandemic, we all saw that certain things can be done online. Certain things don't need to be done as often as usual. I mean, for example, there are not many scientists flying around to conferences anymore. And of course, this is not what we want. Obviously, everyone wants to go to a conference, to meet people, to have the famous coffee break where most Nobel Prize winning ideas are being discussed. And it's not happening it's not necessarily happening in a Zoom conference, but we see it's possible. So there is no need to be you know, to be over consumptive or consumptive to over consume our resources by frequent flying every second day. And I myself, I was definitely flying over the budget that every person should do. So I myself take that as a very good learning opportunity not to fly anymore as often as usual.
Well, I don't think we're going to answer that question pretty well, considering it's such a heavy topic. But I think we can do our own part. I think both of us being educators, we have the opportunity to instill an enthusiasm into our students. And so hopefully they will become good science communicators, whether it is just generally or in a career path, so that they can share amongst others the importance of science understanding and science literacy. That's a nice segue into my next question. So you have a student who's thinking about possibly doing a career in science. They haven't decided yet, but maybe, you know, they're open to the idea. What would encourage would you to give to say, go for it?
I would exactly say that, go for it. They do need encouragement. And first of all, I would always tell them that, and I do, I always tell students when they ask me to stay curious, because I think curiosity is the main driver in every endeavor. And it's not just restricted to science. It's really whenever you want to do something, it can be in the arts, it can be in philosophy, it can be in business. You have to be curious. You have to be the person who wants to know more, because that will be a driver. That will be your motivation. Getting into science is fascinating in that sense that you really, there are so many learning opportunities and this very famous wow effect, which can be just by understanding something. And it's something that at the beginning you have quite often, and you might not even appreciate it that much, but the moment you continue and you are in the field already and you studied and you find something that you always knew, but you never fully understood it. And then you understand it for the first time and you have this wow. This is a feeling that is the kick. That is what it's all about. If you even get to this wow effect where you discover something new, or where you advance our scientific understanding just a little bit, but it's this wow, that is new. I did that. This feeling is the best. And so, well, obviously, how do you get there? What is required? The good thing is, at the moment, especially for students, there is a lot of science communication going on online that is really nicely accessible. I mean, we can talk about the famous YouTubers who do amazing stuff. I mean, we can talk about Physics Girl, we can talk about Veritasium, Smarter Every Day, all those amazing communicators. They give such a nice overview of what science is, because sometimes science is portrayed as, if you go into physics, you will end up in a lab. You will always be, you know, or if you go to chemistry, you will end up with a white coat and this is it. But every aspect of science has so many different paths that you can take, and it's not really foreseeable where you will end up, so that you just have to start, and you have to start and you have to continue doing it. And this is probably the biggest challenge in every aspect, but in science it gets frustrating. And this is really something that I think is a shared it's a shared property of all scientists, is that they continue doing it, although it's frustrating. It looks like a dead end. The research is not going anywhere, or the results are just not clear. That is the frustrating part. And I would be lying if I would say that this is sometimes not really, really upsetting. It is. But there's always the but. If you continue going, and if you then manage to overcome those challenges, this is the feeling. This is what we are chasing. It's this yes, that makes sense. So, long story short, for students at high school level at the moment, watch the videos of YouTubers, but also start reading. And there are fantastic books that are really intended for the audience of high school students to explain any aspect of science. It doesn't have to be physics. There are also fantastic resources for biology, chemistry, where you really either read up on the history of the field, because that helps you a lot, or to really illustrate what are the open questions.
I think just touching on something that you said, I think a lot of students or even teachers who watch this probably know that, for example, if they're doing different subjects, it's often the harder subjects are actually the one that are more enjoyable. Yes, it's harder or more challenging. I think that's a better word. And sometimes it is frustrating, but it pays so much more dividends when you get that moment where you go, oh, I get it, as opposed to something that you might just coast through. And in many respects, science is like that. You're right. There are times when, you know, as you say, you're doing research, you're collecting data and so forth. I mean, you know, CERN's a good example. You know, switch on 2008, 2012 was when we actually presented, and that was just really the beginning of understanding the Higgs boson. You know, it's not the end. People can forget that, you know, 2012's announcement was not like the end all of Higgs. We're only just beginning the journey of understanding the Higgs boson, right? So it can be equally frustrating, you know, but it's so rewarding at the end. And I think that's a good thing to encourage students, is don't give up, because it pays dividends, intrinsic dividends. Okay, so I have one more question for you. This is an open-ended question. I'm going to give you an opportunity. I want you to share something you're passionate about and teach me and teach the audience something we don't know yet.
Oh, my goodness me. Okay. Yeah, okay. Okay, I think I have one. Because there are different topics that I'm fascinated about, but I will still stay close to particle physics, but I will go a little bit more into the application side of particle physics. And it's one topic that I'm really, really passionate about, is the so-called medical applications of particle physics. It's in itself, it's kind of a sad topic, because when we talk about medical applications, it has to do with tumors, for example. And it's a sad story, but it's a relevant one. We see tumor cases are on the rise. This has nothing to do with the fact that, I don't know, tumor is spreading. It's just we as humans, we grow older, so we have more chance to develop a tumor over time, and our detection processes are better, so we really can detect them at some point. Okay, long story short, how do we treat tumors? It depends on each case, of course, but there are essentially three options how you do it. It's either by chemotherapy, where you just poison the body and hope that the tumor is poisoned before the body is poisoned. The second is surgery, so you eliminate it. And the third one is radiation. And the radiation part is the one that I want to briefly talk about, because in the past, we started by X-raying tumors. So we really use X-ray, where we all know whoever had an X-ray before, be it for a dental or, I don't know, a broken leg or something, or an arm, you get covered in lead, because we all know X-ray per se is not healthy for the body. It's, in small dosage, it's okay, it's perfectly fine, but we still have to shield all the areas we don't want to X-ray, so we direct it. So obviously, if we use X-ray to treat a tumor, we do influence all the healthy tissues around it. And here is where particle physics comes in, because X-rays are photons and they interact with matter in a certain way. But we at CERN, we accelerate protons among other particles, but mainly protons. And we already saw that if instead of using X-rays, we can use accelerated protons, protons interact completely differently when they interact, they behave differently when they interact with matter. So we see a so-called Bragg peak. So the Bragg peak is when a beam of proton goes interacts with matter, most of it just goes through. They lose some energy on the way, but they don't interact. Only less than 20% interact. But then at some point, there is a huge peak, the so-called Bragg peak, where all the remaining energy of this beam is deposited in this one in this one spot. And this depends on the energy of the beam and also the distance and the material. And so this is one way of how we can nowadays use accelerated protons that we at CERN use for our research purposes to treat certain tumor cases. Unfortunately, it's not possible for all tumor cases. But in this case, we can really shoot the beam into the body. We don't influence the healthy tissues around it that much, but we really target the tumor. And for me, when I first learned about that, that was in that way so eye-opening, because never in our life did we think, when we started doing particle physics research more than 65 years ago at CERN, that we would use what we are doing for our research in a daily life. Never ever would we have thought that. But we did it, we did our research, we published everything in open access. People saw it and was like, hey, we can maybe use that in a hospital. And now we have this opportunity. And we can treat and we can significantly increase the life expectancy of people and also their quality of life. And the reason why I'm at the moment very enthusiastic about it is it's still very early on. We have everything developed. It works. It even works even better with carbon ions, for example. But it's only used in a few places around the world, and mainly in the so-called Western world, in high-income countries. We don't have any of those facilities in low or middle-income countries. And this is one thing that I see as incredibly unfair, because it's always with the difference between different income countries is getting larger and larger. So this is one of the big things that I am at the moment trying to investigate, how education especially, how can we train the scientists of tomorrow around the world to increase the capacity within the country to install, for example, hadron treatment centers in low or middle income countries. So, because that will make a significant impact on health, global health system. So that would be my TED talk that I shortened down now in 3 minutes.
That's great. And that just touches on really how important science research is. You know, so the fact is, it's not just this esoteric guy, it has benefits to society, you know, and that's a great example. And, you know, the fact that we're sitting here talking on the internet, you know, that's come from CERN. The fact that I can play it on my touchscreen or whatever like that, you know, again, capacitive touch comes from CERN. So the fact is that, yes, science and understanding is paramount, but society benefits so much, doesn't it, and as a result. And that's a great example. So thanks for sharing that. So, well, thank you very much, Jeff. It's been a great chance to hear about what you do and about science. I want to thank you for your taking the opportunity to talk with us and or talk with me and I guess sharing with the wider world, and maybe an opportunity to speak in the future.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me. I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please remember to subscribe to get notifications of upcoming interviews. And you can find me on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter at Physics High. My name is Paul from Physics High. Till next time.